Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I am so glad you are joining me today. I'm so glad to be with you today. I hope you've had a good day and a good week. We've got a great show lined up. Big question is, are you someone people want to work with? Well, now that the work week is largely behind us, you might reflect back on that. Have you been someone throughout the week that people enjoyed working with? Or was it maybe not so nice or so easy, or maybe you're difficult and that's what it is? But my first guest, Matt Norman, is going to be coming on, and he's going to be talking about the kind of people that people want to work with. So that's going to be very interesting. And then I just invented a new segment today called Friday with Friends, where I thought, you know, on occasional Friday, I'm just going to call up a friend of mine and find out what's going on in their life. And my friend Dave Sr. is going to be joining the show. And Dave spent a lot of time having his morning quiet time at the cathedral at Notre Dame. So it really did have quite an impact on him when he watched it burn to the ground. And then Dr. Alex McFarland will be joining me in the second hour. And Dr. Paul Kengor is going to be joining me as well in the second hour. So that's what's all ahead on the show today. I am so glad that you've decided to spend this time together. I can hardly wait to get things started. So let me take about 60 seconds and get things underway with Matt Norman.
As a Christian business leader, you're in the mission field every day. Whether you're a CEO, manager, or entrepreneur, you're called to the business of making disciples. The Rise Up Business Leader Breakfast was created to help you impact your workplace for Christ and His kingdom with rising confidence and intentionality. The Rise Up Business Leader Breakfast takes place Tuesday, May 21st at the University of Northwestern, St. Paul. You'll enjoy a full breakfast and opportunity to network with other faith-filled professionals, learn from compelling, insightful speakers, and find biblically-based solutions to your business challenges. Learn more and register today at unwsp.edu/riseup. That's unwsp.edu/riseup. You can impact your workplace for Jesus. Find out how at the Rise Up Business Leader Breakfast on Tuesday, May 21st. Register at unwsp.edu/riseup.
Welcome to the show. I'm excited to talk to Matt Norman. He is an exceptional, bright, energetic guy. He's got his own company, mattnorman.com. You can go learn about him. He uses a lot of Dale Carnegie training and also does a lot of consulting and does all kinds of stuff. So words that pop into my head are confident, competent, enthusiastic. But I don't want to talk about me anymore. Let's bring Matt on. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Bill. It's great to connect with you.
Yeah,
thanks
thank
for
you.
That.
Yeah. Now, when you were presenting recently to a friend's company, and the message was, are you the kind of person people want to work with? Boy, did that get my attention.
Did it? What was it that got your attention?
Just the title. Because yeah. I instantly, of course, you start listening autobiographically and you think, huh, am I the guy? Am I the kind of person people enjoy working with? Or... Well, then I wondered, what are the criteria? How would I evaluate based on that if I would be a person that people would enjoy working with?
Yeah, yeah. I think often we tolerate working with others, or perhaps we're cordial working with others, maybe because we have to, because they're our boss, that we depend on them for a role in our organization. Mm-hmm. But if we have the opportunity to stop working for them or with them, we, in many cases, would probably take that opportunity. And so the question is, do people really want to work with you, or do they just have to work with you?
That's a really good question. So there must be some criteria you have for doing some diagnostics on this.
That's right. And those criteria can also be used as ideas to become more of the type of person that people okay. want to work with. They really are, that they gravitate towards. I think about myself, for example, during a period in my life when I was very stressed, probably focused too much on results and not enough on how those results were being accomplished. And as much as people would smile when they'd see me and I think describe me as a competent person and, you know, a nice person, an ethical person, I think deep down, people were not moving towards me. They were generally moving away from me. And so, you know, certainly one part, one diagnostic is looking at the people around you and determining, are they moving away or for me or towards me? I know of a client in town who, again, great company, great person, great leader, and yet people are leaving that company right now. Not in droves, but slowly they're finding other opportunities. And so that's certainly one data point.
That's real interesting. So are you a person that are drawing others to yourself, or are you the kind of person that people are maybe avoiding in the halls or avoiding altogether?
Yeah. Are people reaching out? Am I getting invited? Are people remaining committed to the cause, to the organization? You know, often we'll see, and this applies not just to companies, but this could apply to, you know, being on an elder board at church, for example, or a deacon. This could be a volunteer group that we're a part of in the community. And the question is, are people eager to attend your meetings? Are they showing up on time? Are they participating? Do they seem comfortable and excited to be there? Are they finding new ways to get involved? These would all be indicators. Are they vulnerable? Are they willing to open up? And do they, you know, are they transparent with you? These would all be indicators that you're someone that they really want to work with versus someone that they just sort of, tolerate.
Mm-hmm. So, Matt, is this a skill set that all of us can learn, do you think, or is it just what you're born with and it's what you got?
Well, I'm really a believer in a growth mindset, you know, based on the research by Carol Dweck at Stanford University, published in the book Mindset, that indicates that, you know, certainly there are certain talents or gifts or personality styles that are hardwired in us that we're not necessarily going to change. But, you know, Carol Dweck's research in the book Mindset indicates that we can change. This concept of neuroplasticity.
Oh, yeah.
That neuroscientists would say that our brain can change. And I particularly believe, and this also is borne out in the book Quiet, which I think you and I have talked about before, Susan Cain's book Quiet, which would indicate that whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, and in fact, particularly introverts, are able to really connect well with people, perhaps in ways that extroverts aren't. And so whether we're an introvert or extrovert, whether we are 20 years old or 80 years old, whether we are someone that's socially anxious or socially comfortable, or whether we're analytical or tend to have more of a sales and marketing customer service type role, all of us can be someone that others really want to work with.
Mm-hmm. So as we examine this, am I someone people want to work with? One of the first indicators, Matt, is do they stay clear of me or are they drawn in by me? What would be another indicator that we would look for?
So I think the degree to which people are opening up around us, you know, are they disclosing, are they transparent, are they vulnerable around us, or are they guarded? And do they tend to hold back?
And that would be a complicated point, I think, because companies, elder boards, they can be all very complicated, and people have their own agendas, and they may be withholding information from other people as well. I'm just trying to think through this one out loud. So
yeah, that's right. That's yeah. I think it requires a lot of self-awareness, you know, external awareness of what's happening with the people around me, looking for body language. You know, for example, if I sit on an elder board and I look around the room, or if I'm on a nonprofit board of directors and I look around the room, are people leaning forward with an open posture? Are they engaging and participating proactively in the conversation? Or do they sit back, cross their arms, and sort of passively participate? That would be an indicator that perhaps me as the leader of that group, or as one of the leaders or facilitators, that perhaps there are people that are less engaged than I like them to be, or that they could be. That would be one indicator. Then the other would just be, you know, there's moments when people share something that's perhaps a bit more personal or risky, that requires some psychological safety to say out loud. And, or have they pursued us, you know, have they pulled us aside and said, "Hey, I'd like to share something with you," you know, or in a one-on-one interaction with them, are they saying, "See, by the way, you know, can I tell you about something that's going on in my life?" You know, I think those are all indicators that someone's leaning towards us rather than away from us.
Mm-hmm. So would that be a way that a person could act in order to have others open up to them?
I mean, that's a great point.
When you open up to somebody, then they open up to you. And that also takes a risk. I love that expression, psychological risk, because I think that sums it up well. Because how do we improve on becoming a person others want to open up to?
Yeah. I think, you know, so I recently wrote an article. You referenced mattnorman.com. I wrote an article on that site, mattnorman.com, around this question. And I indicated four things that we can do to cause people to lean towards us rather than away from us. And one of those factors is to cultivate a magnetic personality. And again, that doesn't mean that you're always gregarious, you know, and the loudest person in the room. It's just that you're an attractive person. You're someone that people, and I don't mean physically, I mean personally attractive. And one of those factors is that I can manage my own anxiety, that I can manage and understand my own hot buttons or triggers, and that I'm predictable. That if I share something with you, for example, that you aren't going to fly off the handle. You're not going to judge me or shame me based on what I said, or that you aren't going to respond one way one time and another way a different time just based on the mood I'm in. And so I think a lot of it has to do with managing our own anxiety. And then also, as I alluded to, not being someone who's shaming or judgmental. And that would extend into criticism and complaining, that I'm not someone has a negative spirit towards others. I don't mean constructive criticism. There's certainly a time to speak truth. At the same time, that we're someone who's not a negative spirit, that we're tending to look towards the positives in other people and in situations.
Yeah. Matt, how important is nonverbal communication, body language, eye contact, the kind of, you know, just things that go on in offices every day that would indicate to someone, "Ooh, I think this person would be happy to talk to me or happy to listen," because they're always so attentive and they're always so nice. So how important is that nonverbal language that goes on?
Yeah, I think it's so important. There's been so much research based on how quickly we make decisions about the trustworthiness of others based on the nonverbals. And, you know, so much of that has to do with posture, with eye contact. And increasingly today, I think with technology, it's particularly important because we may be in meetings where we hide behind devices.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And of course, that could occur even virtually, right? Where I was in a number of meetings today. One was on a Zoom meeting, and I was on a WebEx meeting earlier today. And in some cases, there were video cameras, so we could at least see some of the nonverbals. But in some of the cases, there weren't. And, you know, if we hear typing going on in the background, or it's perceived that you're multitasking, You know, a lot of these factors can ultimately convey whether we're someone that is really, you know, that other people are drawn to us, or are they tolerating us, as the case may be.
Yeah. Matt Norman is my guest. Go to mattnorman.com. He trains, he teaches, he coaches, he facilitates, he speaks. He does kind of everything. We're going to take a little break, and he will be back with us more in about 90 seconds. Have Matt Norman on my guest line. Matt has aligned himself with Dale Carnegie and has done a tremendous job training and coaching and facilitating and speaking, and does organizational alignment. You can learn more about Matt at mattnorman.com. We're talking about today, are you the kind of person other people want to work with? And we're trying to break this down a little bit and figure out what we can learn and what we can get better at. And so, Matt, just to bring listeners up to speed if they just joined us. So far, we're learning that it helps to be magnetic. It helps to be someone that people can trust and connect to. And that's all stuff we can work on, which is encouraging.
That's right. And frankly, Bill, I think you demonstrate so much of this. I think for people who have been listening to you and following your career, you know, you're both someone who listens and asks great questions. You know, you've also are, you know, fun and entertaining. People like to be around you, and then you also are able to connect with people on the harder side of life as you talk to people. You know, I know in your other podcast on, you know, addictions and so forth, that you know, you're creating psychological safety, which I think draws people into you, and that's really what we want to try to be, is someone that people see as safe. And that people see that if they're going to interact with us, they're not going to be met with criticism or judgment or, you know, emotional triggers as much as by affirmation and grace.
So, Matt, is there more to the, are you the kind of person that people are going to want to work with, or have we covered it?
So there's a few other points, you know, certainly one would be that we have a generous spirit, that we're more, we have an abundance mindset versus a scarcity mindset. You know, are we willing to give before expecting someone in something in return? And another factor would be that we're clear in our messaging. Much of the neuroscience we spoke about earlier also indicates that, you know, human beings are wired to survive. And if we're confusing in our messaging, if we take too long to explain something, people will shut down. They'll turn off the podcast. They'll turn the station. Many of us, when we have a lot of subject matter expertise, or we have a lot of detail behind our perspectives, we're tempted to just unload it on people, you know, kind of give them the full case before the jury. And it can often be hard to digest or overwhelming. That's another reason why people might lean away from us rather than towards us. So those are a couple of factors.
Yeah, I love that. Would you follow up with some more on the abundance versus the scarcity mentality and how that would show up in our personality?
Yeah, you know, Adam Grant, is the professor at Wharton School of Business, is one of my favorite authors and a friend who wrote the book Give and Take. And in the book, he talks about research indicating that there are givers, takers, and matchers in the world. And givers are those people that tend to lead with generosity, give without necessarily expecting something in return. There are takers that are, you know, based on, that are fundamentally oriented towards consumption and grabbing everything they can get. And then there are matchers, which is all quid pro quo, right? It's eye for an eye. If you'll give me this, I'll give you that. And the research indicates that Adam Grant did, that the givers, now you have to be a strategic giver. He indicates in the book, you can't just always be giving without any boundaries or any thought as to your own self-care. But having said that, those that are more oriented towards generosity are more successful in any area, in any type of organization.
That's real interesting. I know we all want to be a person on the job or on the elder board or on a committee that people like to be around. So you, this has been very helpful. I would love for you to talk with our time remaining about getting what you want in life by figuring out a way to reduce some of your stress and anxiety. Now, you've shared in the past some of your social anxieties and stuff, which is a great story, by the way. And
thank you.
You've gone from someone who is nearly paralyzed with anxiety and fear to being, you know, the doing what you're doing for a living right now. So it's fantastic. But we all want, obviously, happiness, health. We want work success. We want our families to be well. I mean, we want to serve the Lord well, and we want to do all of this. But we've got certain stress and anxieties that we deal with as well. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. It's you know what I've learned, and you talked about my journey dealing with anxiety. Something I am wired in many ways to battle. It's the a thorn in my side is often catastrophic what if thinking and wondering if I'm enough, if I'm measuring up, and so much of that is self focused, and I think as we get outside of ourselves and really focus on others, I've found that my anxiety is lowered. I remember my first Dale Carnegie course that was recommended to me to take because of my social anxiety and just discomfort in meetings. Again, this is something that people would have been unsuspecting of at the time. I was able to fake it, but inside I was just uncomfortable in meetings and conference rooms and so forth. So someone recommended I take a Dale Carnegie course. And I remember being in the parking lot after the course of one of the early sessions and describing this anxiety to the instructor of the course. And he looked at me, he said, "Matt, it's not about you." And I said, "Well, I understand, you know, yeah, my values are certainly others oriented." He said, "No, Matt, it's not about you." And it was like that moment in in Good Will Hunting, you know, where Robin Williams looks at Matt Damon and just keeps repeating the same phrase until I think I finally broke down and was emotional in that moment, just realizing that so much of my thinking was self-focused. You know, am I enough? What if things don't work out for me? And so really, I think this is a key ingredient in following Jesus is to, and I think Jesus models this. I think in many ways, why he's such a magnetic personality, why people gravitate towards Jesus is because he is not anxious. He's so others oriented. He has an abundance mindset. He meets us with love rather than judgment. And so this is really about, it's about following Jesus and therefore it's about having life and having it abundantly.
C.S. Lewis said that you find happiness in your peripheral vision. So when you're serving someone, you kind of pause and look to both sides and go, "Wow, I'm really happy right now."
Yeah.
But when you're trying to make yourself happy, you're never going to find happiness because you're too self-focused. So your point is beautifully expressed and well taken. It's a fantastic message for all of our listeners, including this one particular radio host.
Thank you for saying that, Phil.
Yeah, yeah. Norman.com. You can see his smiling face. It's a handsome one. So, Matt, thanks again for doing the show.
Thankful for you, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Yep. We'll take a short break, and we will be back with lots more in just a minute.
That's mercyships.org.
Welcome back to the show. You know, I think I'm going to start a new segment called Fridays with Friends. Fridays with Friends. Yeah, I just came up with that idea about 8 seconds ago. And I figured on an occasional Friday, I will call a friend and just find something to talk about. So to get things started, I called a friend, my friend Dave Sr., who formerly lives in both Los Angeles and Hawaii. So I'm naturally a little envious of the fact he's looking at the ocean today from his home in Hawaii, but he's agreed to join me, and we've got an interesting topic to discuss. Dave, welcome to the show.
Oh, good to be here. Thanks for calling, Bill.
Thank you so much. And you you and I go back way to high school, and that was when we first met, and You were one class ahead of me in high school, and then we went off to college together, and you came over and pulled up into my driveway, and we went to college together. You were going to be a sophomore. I was a freshman, and we got in your white car and drove to Texas.
You know, you're bringing up other flashbacks of wonderful memories, like as we confirmed with oaths to each other that we would keep each other awake.
Yes.
As we drove all night down to Texas.
Yeah.
And heads bobbing up and down, peaceful awake.
Oh, you know, we decided we'd split up the driving, but you took the first 12 hours. And then when you got tired, you let me take over. And that was the exact time I was tired.
Because we've been talking for 12 hours.
Right,
you didn't
right.
sleep at all then. Yeah.
And we both, yeah. I think I was driving and I did nod off and fall asleep. And fortunately, when I woke up, the car was only going about 18 miles an hour and we were headed towards the side of the road. And we got ourselves quickly back on track. So
I do remember waking up and watching your head bobbing up and down. And I thought, he's joking. He's just doing this to mess with me.
No, I was sound asleep.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
We're in the middle of Kansas in the middle of the night.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I know. So, anyway, you go on from high school, you go to college, then you go to law school. Then you move to Los Angeles. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, went to Los Angeles, you know, at 22 or so to, you know, because the grass is greener, the trees are taller, you're young and foolish. And,
right.
And also pretty much no more at age 22, I think, than you know at any time in your life. And so that's a good idea. And at the time, my family had moved to Minnesota when I was 14 from the East Coast, from Connecticut. And then I moved down to Texas and I went out there and I just kind of, at that stage of life, thought I was kind of in this groove where you'll just kind of bounce along every 5 years and move to someplace new, and went out there and never really expected to stay. But then what I didn't know is sometimes you get a job and things work out. And then all of a sudden, you know, then you're married and you have children and you got a job and things are going jobs. So decades roll by. And that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. One of the things I had heard about from a mutual friend of ours was your time spent at Notre Dame, and you have spent lots and lots of time there. And I thought it would be really interesting to talk to you about the perspective you have from, a believing Christian that wants to go and have his quiet time in the monstrosity known as Notre Dame, and then how the fire sort of, how it came up, how it struck you and how it affected you and all that.
Well, yeah, when the news broke of the fire during Easter week, it really caught my attention and had a big impact. But I was just thinking about this. I went to Notre Dame. I was in college, and it was one of those backpack across Europe events. And it's on the to-do list of go to Paris, go see these things, and Notre Dame was on there, and you went, and it was this kind of iconic, spectacular, jaw-dropping cathedral that for someone who's 19 and hasn't been outside the United States, you'd never see anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, at that age, at that point in life, it just kind of had a profound effect on me. I'm not Catholic. But it's clearly a place of Christian worship. And the time I spent in there, not speaking French, you know, I guess ignorance is bliss or whatever. So it was a wonderful place to go and spend some time in prayer or reflection or meditation. And so that kind of became a thing. And then over the years, I would return back to Paris, one reason or another, sometimes every 5 years, maybe 7 years. And I would always go back and make sure I saw it and really enjoyed it. Last year, after having not been to France since 2009 for one reason or another. I went to Spain for the first time in my life, and actually started in France and did the Camino de Santiago. And that was 5 weeks, a pilgrimage from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port to Santiago, Spain. And then I went on to Finisterre. And when I finished, my wife met me there, and we had made arrangements to rent an apartment and go spend a month in Paris. And the reason being because I've always thought kind of, it just seemed like a dream, if nothing else, that everybody should, you know, live in Paris at some point and see what it's like. And so that was about as close as I was going to get, was to go over there for a month and relax and spend some time and work remotely and see Paris. And when we got there, our apartment was literally 3 minutes away from Notre Dame. And first day there, I went over to Notre Dame and looked around and saw it in its spectacular manner that it is, and came back to the apartment, and I said to myself, you know, it takes 3 minutes to walk over there. You are a fool if you don't walk over there every morning as it's opening and just go spend some time in there in prayer. So for the rest of the month, I think it was about 30 days, I went over there every morning, and I kind of got it down to where I knew when the tour groups were arriving and getting set up to go in, and I knew where the quick kind of access line was to get into the cathedral, and then where to go to get into the kind of the inner sanctuary, which was kind of closed off to tourists, but there for practitioners, and then made my way up to the front of the cathedral and would spend some time in prayer. I was kind of coming right off doing the Camino, where one of my objectives there was to kind of turbocharge my prayer life, if you will, you know, see if I could enhance that, spend a little more time in prayer. We got 24 hours every day, and it's real easy, and no one will catch you if you cut corners on prayer time.
That's so true.
Nobody really knows.
That's true.
And I have some issues with prayer. I mean, there's things that kind of make me, you know, raise an eyebrow or whatever. People pray different ways, different denominations, different faiths approach prayer differently. But when I hear kind of prayer being thrown around as almost cliche, like, you know, you're in my prayers, or I'll think about you. It's like, I always wonder, like, do you really mean that? And if so, how are you doing that?
It's a comfortable cliche for many.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And especially bandied about in situations that are really troubling. You know, loss of a friend or a loved one, or a traumatic event in one's life, whether it be work or with a friend or a health issue. And I just don't want to get to the end of the road here and have God say to me, remember when you told these 632,000 people that they were in your prayers? And I wanted to try to like see if I could up the ante a little
right.
bit. And I figure, you know, we got 24 hours in a day. I'd love to say that I sleep for 8 hours, but as I get older, I'm really ecstatic if I can pull off six, which leaves me with about 18 hours. And if I spend an hour in prayer a day, you're not really breaking the bank on your available time. And I do think it changes your attitude. And I think this is something that you, Bill Arnold, would fully understand is, you've always been fit and you've stayed fit, and it doesn't happen from just sitting on the couch eating donuts. It happens because you are very disciplined and you take some time, and whether it's with weights or aerobics or whatever, you do something and you do it regularly, and therefore you're fit. You're physically fit. And come a time where you're running late for a flight and you're in the airport and you have to run through the terminal to get to your gate to board the plane, you're not like feeling like you're going to have a heart attack and your head's going to explode. It's like, you know, you're physically fit and you're ready to take on the day's work. And I think, you know, between work and other things, we, you know, reading and things like that, we try to stay mentally fit. And equally important, in my view, is I think it's always good to try to have an element of spiritual fitness. And that can come, in my view, through prayer, meditation, contemplation. You know, there's many ways that authors have written about it, and I did a little more reading about it as I was marching along for 5 weeks across Spain. And I just think it makes you spiritually fit so that when things pop up from time to time, like all day long or all week long, mm-hmm. that your natural reaction becomes something a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more positive, a little less worrisome, a little more in stride with confidence than running around, you know, willy-nilly, hoping that the sky isn't falling right now.
Right.
And so we all know these things, and so what's the, as long as we know it, we want to try to exercise a little discipline, both mental fitness, physical fitness, spiritual fitness, exercise a little discipline to do it.
Yeah. It's a great word, Dave.
Yeah.
Discipline is screaming off the page today. Let me take a little break. You're listening to Fridays with Friends, and this is the first time I've done this. I just came up with this idea like 5 minutes ago. So I called my friend Dave Sr. He's coming all the way from beautiful 50th state, which I think is Hawaii. Yeah, that's it. So we'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I've got my friend Dave Sr. on the phone, and today's a new segment called Friday with Friends, where I just call up one of my friends and say, what up? Find something to talk about. And Dave is talking about his experience for 30 days being in Paris, going to Notre Dame every day for prayer time and for worship. And I'm curious, Dave, when you go in and you experience the enormity of this building and this, this cathedral, what did it teach you or show you about just the enormity of God and the need we have for worship?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this when the news reports were coming out, and I was watching on the news the fire that was underway. It's like, you know, there's something that I think is important in life with material possessions and material things that we encounter in life. You know, the I've seen people own really fancy, nice cars, particularly when 30 years of living in Los Angeles, it's like you are what you drive.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, and they, they're so concerned about it and so concerned about the care and the washing and the look and the appearance and everything that, they can't really enjoy it. And, I've always kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, you own the car doesn't own you. And if it ever gets to the point where the car is owning you, you need to get rid of that thing and move on to something else.
Yeah.
And when I saw Notre Dame and the fire and the impact that it had, I mean, it was jaw dropping and watching it go. And it was just awful. It was awful. And it made me stop and think for a second, like, you know, this is a cathedral for worship. it is not the object of worship. And if that cathedral has gotten to the point where it means more to me than the practical aspects of what it provides. Car provides transportation, keeps you dry, keeps the wind off you. And Notre Dame provides a place for worship and an opportunity to spend time in many different ways with your spiritual life. If it's not providing that, but it's become this iconic possession, then you got your priorities kind of twisted. And in watching it burn, if you will, I remember thinking, hang on a second here. This is a place you've seen many times. This is a place you've gone to many times. This is a place where not many people that I know have had an opportunity to go there daily, to be in prayer for an hour, for every day for a month, and what it provided to me. Therefore, I find sadness in what I'm seeing with the fire. But Notre Dame itself, the icon of cathedrals that it is, to me, is an expression of people in relationship with God and trying to do something so majestic, so huge, as an expression to what the Lord must be that much greater than, and that they want to make that expression to the Lord that you are this so big that we want something so magnificent to be a place where we can come and try to express to you our understanding of your enormity. And so looking at it from that side, then I thought, if that's the viewpoint, I'd very much like to see it be restored and that people appreciate that in the restoration process, so that going forward, it rekindles and lights a fire of real adoration and appreciation to God.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah. Dave, if you take out the people that would be hostile to God, hostile to the gospel, wouldn't you say that the majority of people that saw that fire on TV, and obviously the people in Paris seeing it in person, that the emotion was absolutely stunned disbelief?
That's the reaction I had on it, and I think many did, for a multitude of reasons. You know, whether it's merely it's the age or the ability to create such a thing back then is now gone. The artifacts that were in the cathedral, the disruption that it will cause to people that worship there. The 13 million tourists, I don't, that sounds like a negative word, but the 13 million people that make a pilgrimage to Notre Dame to see it every year. And think about that. I think so many people, for so many different reasons, were just so distraught and troubled by what they saw.
Yeah.
And interestingly, you know, it occurring during Holy Week, and the pictures that followed in the days that followed really had a sense of restoration and opportunity and growth and renewal. And renewal. I mean, Easter is all about renewal.
Right.
When you saw what actually was damaged, what was not damaged, and how restoration can go about. And I'm hopeful that restoration of that cathedral is more about restoration, which is something that we all can use a bit more of. So,
okay, we got a couple minutes left, Dave. Let me try to extrapolate to this point, and I only use the word extrapolate with my lawyer friends because I'm not entirely sure what it means. But you look at the stunned disbelief of Notre Dame burning. What about the stunned disbelief that the disciples must have had watching their Savior hang on the cross?
You know, that very thought hit me. I was sitting there as I was watching the cathedral on fire and knew how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, the fact that it was during Easter week, I was thinking, what they lost then, you know, as we're seeing symbolically what we lost with Notre Dame that week. Keep in mind, when they lost Christ, they had no idea what was coming.
Right.
I mean, the finality was on Friday.
Right.
In their observations and what they knew. I mean, they didn't know, oh, by the way, it wasn't like some television show where, you know, at the end of the arc, something, you know, there's something, this is going to be a positive.
There's going to be a happy ending with this one. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And what was going on Friday and the loss and the lack of knowing and to put all your faith in Christ and see something occur that you never could imagine it happening.
Yeah.
To God, the Son of God. You know?
Right.
I just can't, I mean, absence of hope, the despair, the heartache, the pain, it would be at an extreme level that I don't think any of us can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unbelievable. You know, I have loved having this time chatting with you. And is the weather perfect today in Hawaii?
You know, it's as I look out off my lanai, there is one kind of still low-hanging cloud over the peak on Molokai.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
But other than that,
it's perfect.
You know, sun is shining.
Yeah.
And that actually may be part of the perfection. I don't know.
Okay.
I'll have to think that over.
All right. You've been listening to a new segment I just invented called Friday with Friends, and my friend has been Dave Sr. Dave, thanks for doing the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's been a blast.
Great talking with you.
Yep.
Catching up.
Yep.
All right, Bill.
We'll take a short break and be right back.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. Parenting teenagers can be extremely frustrating, but also extremely rewarding. Mark Gregston is author of the book Parenting Teens in a Confusing Culture, and he offers this advice for parents of teens.
More than anything else, what's important for a parent to communicate to their kids is, I want a relationship with you, and there's nothing you can do to make me love you more, and there's nothing you can do to make me love you less. It's a phrase that every child should embrace in this performance and appearance world. They need to know at their very core that they are loved and there's nothing they can do, no sin, no difficulty, no struggle, no inappropriate behavior that will change my love for you. Now, there's consequences, and I think every family's got to line those out. But at some point, it's letting the child know in the absence of relationships in other parts of their life that you can find one with your good old mom and dad. And I think that becomes very important in these days.
More from Mark Gregston is at myfaithradio.com.
All right, coming up just ahead, Dr. Alex McFarland is going to be joining the program. He was named the National Student Movement Director for the National Day of Prayer, which was yesterday, so we're going to find out all about that. And then Dr. Paul Kengor, he's going to be joining me as well in the second half hour. He's the author and professor of political science at Grove City College. This guy is so unbelievably smart. That's all ahead coming up in the next hour. Thanks for joining me. I can't wait for hour two, just around the corner. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.